All right, guys, welcome. Welcome to my session. I'm Ray Bango. I'm a community manager at Microsoft, and I focus primarily on JavaScript, HTML, and CSS. I'm also an editor of a site called scriptjunkie.com. It's a great site on cross-browser JavaScript, HTML, and CSS content. I'm a member of the jQuery team. I write for various publications, and I'm also an HTML5 and JavaScript fanboy. This is a site that I manage. I'm obviously doing a pimp job here. I'm pimping it out. Guys, go here, scriptjunkie.com. It's a great site, awesome content, awesome authors, guys that you will know who are writing for the site. So definitely hit it up, scriptjunkie.com. Every day I talk to developers, and one of the most common questions I get is, Ray, how do we use HTML5 and CSS3 today while still supporting non-modern browsers? And, you know, that's a really awesome question. And from a development perspective, it makes total sense. And so what this prompted me to do is come up with a presentation that kind of identified the issues that are going on with HTML5 and CSS3, especially things like browser fragmentation, where we have all these different browser versions going around, and they all have varying levels of support for not only HTML5 and CSS3 features, but HTML and CSS itself. So that's a big problem. And I wanted to try to come up with techniques and technologies that I could share with you guys that help to bridge the gap and allow you to use HTML5 and CSS3 today, things like feature detection and polyfills. And I'll go into a little bit about these technologies and techniques during the presentation. But the main thing I wanted to provide in this session was solutions that you can take home today and start using to build really awesome websites leveraging HTML5 and CSS3. Now, how many of you have started using HTML5 and CSS3 right now? Are you guys pretty excited about it? Woo! Yeah, sorry, I get all pumped up. So. All right, so HTML5, for those who don't know, it's the newest specification of the HTML5 programming language. I call it a programming language because I feel like it kind of is. You know, it's evolving. It's evolving past just being a markup language where you're going to have very generic things. And it's supported by all the major modern browsers, including IE9, you know, obviously Mozilla Firefox, Google Chrome, Safari, and Opera. And look, we even got a really, really neat, snazzy little logo. You know, everybody love that logo? To me, that's like a little Superman thing. I got to get a t-shirt and just put it on there and go, woo, HTML5. But the problem is browser support. We obviously still have a varying level of support for browsers. I mean, we have to support IE6 through 8. We have to support Firefox 3.0 through 3.6, Opera 10 and below. And that's where some of these issues come in. All right, we have a lot of non-modern browsers. And when I mean non-modern browsers, is they're not supporting a lot of the features that are coming out today. And here's a pretty good list. And I'm referencing caniuse.com because it's such a great site for listing out what's being supported among most of the major browser versions. And even modern browsers have issues. I don't want to just paint this a picture of saying, hey, we have non-modern browsers out there and they're having problems. No, even modern browsers have issues because, again, the thing is that we have varying levels of support between even browser versions. And this is what I call browser fragmentation. I jumped over to a site called Net Market Share. I just wanted to kind of check out the different browsers, you know, the different browser shares and see what's going on. And as I looked through this site, I was floored. I mean, look at this. Netscape 6.0 is still up there with a lot of, you know, a pretty decent market share. Now, you might look at it and you might say, all right, what do they have? They have like 0.64%. Well, to you, that might be small. But to a site, that might be 1 to 10% of their traffic, and that's pretty huge. And then you have like names like Microsoft Internet Explorer 6.0, the World Edition. Has anybody heard of that? You want it? All right. And then how about that one? Look, Safari on Windows 53 Maxon Edition. All right, come on. All right, so this is also an interesting testament to some of the user agent and browser detection issues that we're also encountering. These are probably user agent strings in some capacity. And think about the fact that if you're doing browser detection and you're depending on user agent strings, how are you going to kind of figure out where all this fits in and how you're going to check for it? And all the, think about the conditional statement you'd have to do. So it's kind of an issue. And then going back into the browser fragmentation, let's take a look at Chrome. And Chrome has, like, there's 3.0, 4.0, 5.0, 6.0, 52, no, I'm sorry, There's so many different versions going on that it makes it difficult. And let's not even get into the topic of mobile devices. You know, that's where there's a lot of fragmentation. So, you know, as a developer, you start saying to yourself, holy cow, this is a major problem. How am I going to build a website that I can depend on my features to work across multiple browsers? And not only multiple browsers, multiple versions of the same exact browser. That's a big issue. And again, like I mentioned, browser detection doesn't work because you're basing code on assumptions. You're saying, hey, there's supposed to be this feature or this bug that's in there, and I'm going to kind of do a browser detection on it, and it's going to work. No, because things change, and they change between browser versions. A feature that you think might be in there might change between, I don't know, Internet Explorer 6 and 7, and then your applications will break. So what are the solutions? Well, the first one is feature detection. This is the one that I really like to promote a lot. And the reason is because you're acting based on what the browser truly supports, not what their version is. And you're typically going to look at standards. I tell people, look at standards when you're building feature detection, because you're going to look at an object. You might look at an object method, a property, or some kind of behavior that is a standards-based feature of that of the language itself. So don't go off and do browser detection. Focus more on the actual standards features that you can identify and then use that to build your application. So for example, in this case, why not just check for a browser? Well, here's a great example. Here we're doing a user agent string check, and we're checking to see if it's MSIE. Well, that looks fine, right? But let's look through this code. What is it doing? It's checking to see if it's Microsoft Internet Explorer, and if it's not Microsoft Internet Explorer, and it's checking to see if this is Microsoft Internet Explorer, and if it is, it should use add event listener if it's a modern browser. But if not, it's going to default to attach event, which is the old style of binding an event in Microsoft Internet Explorer. Well, if you run this code in Internet Explorer 9, it's never going to use add event listener, the newest version, and the W3C standard for event binding. It's always going to default to attach event. You don't want that, because then your boss is going to be ticked off at you, and you're going to end up being desperate and in despair. All right? You don't want that. All right? And mind you, I only use curlers on occasion. All right? So this is a better way of checking. You want to do a feature detect using a standards-based method. You want to say, hey, I want to check for add event listener, which is the W3C standard. And if it's there, then go ahead and bind an event using add event listener. Otherwise, I know that I'm using something like, I don't know, in this case, Internet Explorer, and it's using the old event binding method. So let's go ahead and bind it using attach event. This is a much better way of doing it. It's much more sustainable, and it's future-proof. That way, if a browser should happen to deprecate a feature, let's say, God forbid, that Microsoft decides they don't want to support attach event anymore in IE 10, 11, or whatever it is, your code won't break. All right? You want to try to use feature detection going forward. So let me show you a quick demo of how this would look. So in here, it's a pretty straightforward thing. I'm actually using the same exact code I had in the slide. So I'm checking to see if add event listener is actually there. If it's there, then I want to go ahead and bind an event to this actual anchor tag right here. So I'm going to go through, and if not, then I want to use attach event. So let me bring up Internet Explorer, and I go to my feature detection demo, and of course I have to do this, and let me bring up the F12 tools. Has everybody used the F12 tools today? Okay, the cool thing about the F12 tools is that you can actually change the browser mode within Internet Explorer, and it lets me actually test out different features. So in this case, I'm in browser mode IE9. So if I click on this, I should get a pop-up that says I'm using add event listener. And so when I click on it, sure enough, there it is. Add event listener was used because in the code, I'm using feature detection, and it says if add event listener is available as a property of the window object, then let's bind this event using add event listener. Again, that's the W3C standard way of doing that. Otherwise, if it's not supported, then let's check to see if attach event is there, and let's bind it via attach event. So if I go back to the browser, and I change the document mode, I'm going to change it to Internet Explorer 7 now, which will reload it, and I click, boom, attach event is used. This ensures that going forward, my application won't fail again if something changes. I'm not depending on a specific browser version. I'm depending on a specific standard feature for testing. So what happens when feature detection looks something like this? Oof. All right. How many have had to write code like that for feature detection? It's vicious. It's horrible. Okay? Even the monkeys freaked out by that. So that's why I always recommend a library called Modernizer. It really is the best option. Has everybody heard about Modernizer yet? Who's been using it actively? Cool. And if you notice, there's validation behind it because we recently announced that in the ASP.NET MVC3 tools update, we're going to ship Modernizer. So that's validation that Modernizer is a fantastic library. It really has the broadest breadth of feature detection for HTML5 and CSS3, and it's completely cross-browser, and you can use it with any other library you want. There's widespread adoption, and the guys behind it are actively updating it on a regular basis. So if we're going to test for at font faces, which is what the code you just saw, you can do this, and that's an okay way of doing it. You know, that'll work. But to me, a better way is to do this. Which one do you guys like better? Do you like this? Who likes this better? Troublemaker. All right. To me, that's substantially easier. So let's take a quick look at Modernizer. So if I look at Modernizer, the first thing you need to do is you need to go in there and you need to look. You need to kind of. Oh, sorry, wrong one. I'm loading up Modernizer. In this case, it's just a standard JavaScript file. And then right below it, I'm loading up my favorite JavaScript library in the world, jQuery. Who uses jQuery? Woo! All right. Sorry. And then from here, what I want to do is I want to check to see if my browser supports Canvas by saying if modernizer.canvas. And I want to see if it supports audio. And Modernizer supports audio. Or if my browser supports audio, so I'm going to do modernizer.audio. Then I'm going to dynamically load my Canvas JavaScript file, and I'm going to display some kind of canvasy looking fun stuff. Okay? Otherwise, if it's not there, then I'm going to do something else. So let me bring up my browser. And here's Modernizer. Sorry. Right. So in IE9, it supports Canvas. So you're getting some cool Canvas effects here. You got nice bubbles going off. It's supporting audio that I'm pulling in via the audio tag. Now, if I change my browser, and I'll change the mode back to IE7, well, it doesn't support Canvas, so I'll give you a hamster dance. All right? Let me close this down before you guys have a heart attack. Now, feature detection will only get you part of the way, because as much as feature detection is great, you can actually figure out what's supported. You're going to have some kind of technology that's going to fill in those gaps for you. And that's where polyfills and shims come in. And polyfill was a term that was coined by Remy Sharp, who is actually a really, really awesome HTML5 guru. And so what they do is they're typically like JavaScript, HTML, CSS, and they help to mimic and fill in features that are missing in your browser. So for example, if you were missing, I don't know, geolocation, there might be a polyfill that actually provides geolocation type functionality. The new HTML5 input forms, there's polyfills that provide that capability. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. This is a slide from a friend of mine. His name is Paul Irish, and he summed it up perfectly. A polyfill is a shim that mimics a future API, providing fallback functionality to older browsers. Now, we talk about polyfills and shims, so what's the difference between the two? Well, a polyfill replicates a standards API. So if you get a polyfill that is supposed to mimic geolocation, it's going to mimic the API that's provided in the geolocation specification. A shim will give you that functionality you need, but it's going to have its own API itself, and it really doesn't adhere to any specification. So you have to kind of think about how you're going to manage that. The pros and cons are that, you know, with a polyfill, there's a lot of pros. You have all the functionality you want, and you have the same API. So if that particular feature is not supported in your browser, but then it gets added in, typically you're not going to have to rewrite any code. With a shim, you're going to have a very distinct API, so when that feature comes into the browser, you're going to probably have to rewrite some code. But it might be that stopgap that you need just to get you past that hump. All right, so you've got to have to consider that. So here's a great list of polyfills. Now, one thing I want to stress is that some of these, and you might want to write this URL down, okay? This is a list that's being compiled on a regular basis. Some of these are really good. Some of these are not that great. So it's going to be up to you guys to determine which polyfills you want to use, and you're going to have to vet them. The polyfills that I recommend, that I've used and I've seen other people use on a regular basis and be successful, are things like HTML5 shim, which provides support for semantic tags, or the storage polyfill, which gives you local storage capability, or even like H5F, which gives, it kind of mimics some of the new input types that are provided in HTML5. And as for shims, you have Amplify Store, which gives you storage capabilities across multiple browsers, and you have EasyXDM, which gives you cross-domain messaging capabilities. Again, these are things that I've either used or I've been highly recommended, and I can recommend to you guys and feel good about that. Okay, some considerations. You need to properly vet the code. And I'm sorry I'm giving you this ahead of time, but it's before I dive into polyfills and say, hey, use these, I want you guys to know some of the pros and cons. You need to vet the code, because at the end of the day, you're depending on a third party to provide you with a solution. If you don't know how to code in JavaScript, if you don't know how to use advanced CSS techniques, and you're going to use a polyfill, well, you're going to be stuck later on if something happens, because developers do abandon code. Has anybody run into that problem before, where you use a library and then the code gets abandoned? Okay, several people. So you want to make sure you vet it, okay? And also, in terms of like API consistency, like I mentioned, if you use a shim, you're using a very distinct API. Well, you're going to have to consider that when that feature gets added to the browser, you're going to have to rewrite that code most likely. Either that or you're just going to leave it as is. So these are just some considerations for you to think about. All right? So here's two examples. First of all, I'm going to talk about semantic tags. Semantic tags, I think this is a very common style of laying out your page. How many people have done this type of HTML work? This is a very normal style. It's actually great. There's nothing wrong with it, and you guys can continue to use that, and it's successful. The thing with this is that here we're specifying IDs, and we're giving them some kind of semantic name, but it doesn't really provide a semantic meaning to the sections that you're outlining here. It doesn't give meaning to the page. The browser doesn't know what that is. I said div ID header, but I could have said ray header. I put div ID sidebar. I could have put that as div ID foo, and there's absolutely no meaning. So the browser is completely unaware of what's going on. And so the W3C and WhatWhatG went back and said, you know, we need to kind of figure out a way to give more meaning to documents. And so they created this new set of semantic tags like nav, article, section, and footer, which actually gives meaning to your page itself. So when you start looking at the changes that are happening now, take a look at this. To me, this is a very distinct page. Now the content that is within these particular sections have meaning. And I'll tell you why it's important. My prediction is that as browsers become much more intelligent and much more useful, these semantic tags will be leveraged to provide even more context to the content you're providing. I'll give you an example. There's an address tag. What if you were able to specify a real address within the address tag and the browser was smart enough to use the geolocation API to provide you with location-aware information? Could be ads, it could be sales, it could be businesses. Think about that. Do you think that's possible? Anybody think that's possible? You can raise a hand. And so I predict that that's where browsers are going to go to, that they're going to start leveraging these meaningful tags and the meaningful content to provide you guys as developers and users with more information. So, but the biggest issue, again, is browser support. And what happens is in older browsers, non-modern browsers, they don't recognize the new tags. And that's mainly because the internal style sheets aren't updated to understand what these new tags do. So for example, a div tag is a block level element. And most of us as developers take that for granted. We just expect that in the document flow, it's going to work as expected. But if those new tags aren't, they're not recognized, and the internal style sheets that the browsers ship aren't updated, your document flow is completely hosed. So if you look at the screenshot on the left and the one on the right, you can see the differences when you have tags that aren't recognized versus tags that are recognized. And this is what happens in non-modern browsers. These new semantic tags aren't recognized, so we can't style them effectively, so we have to come up with a solution. So let me show you how we're going to solve that problem. So in here, I have a page which I'm using the new semantic tags. I have header, I have my nav tag, section, you know, article, and it's a very, obviously a very simple type of demo. It's a little mini blog thing that I created. And when I run this, and let me make sure I'm in IE9, boom, it renders like I expected. Now, I'm sorry, I'm not a great graphic designer, but it's kind of what I wanted. So in this case, what I wanted was a decent layout. I wanted to use border radius to have some rounded corners on these article elements. And I just wanted to have a very simple-looking page so I can drive the point home. But if I go back to here and I change it to IE7, look at the way the page comes out. It's all screwed up because Internet Explorer can't recognize these new semantic tags. So how do we fix this? So if I go into my editor again, the first thing I need to do is I want to load up Modernizer, okay? And I'm referring back to Modernizer because it's such a fantastic library. One of the things that the Modernizer team did was they talked to Remy Sharp, and unfortunately there's a rendering bug in Internet Explorer which these new semantic tags aren't recognized at all. And it's a rendering bug that is fixed by JavaScript where you actually create these elements on the fly and insert them into the DOM. And so there was a shim created by Remy Sharp to actually provide that functionality. Well, Modernizer started picking up a lot of steam, and the Modernizer team said, you know what, it makes sense for us to just include this shim automatically. So that way, anybody who wants to use feature detection can take advantage of this automatically. So by including Modernizer, I start getting halfway there. So if I go back to my browser, boom, we immediately see some changes. And now it's because these new elements are there. They're not defined properly because, like, an article tag should be a block-level element, but the internal style sheet is not updated. But at least Internet Explorer recognizes the tags there now. Now I can actually style them. So in order to solve the issue of the way that the element should flow in the actual document flow itself, I use an HTML5 reset. Okay? Now, how many of you have used a reset file? Great, so you all know what it means. A reset file basically provides a baseline set of styling for all your elements. And so what we're doing here is using an HTML5 reset, and it's basically a standard reset. There's nothing fancy about it. The only difference is that down here, let me pull this up. Bear with me one second, let me find it. If you look here, we're actually defining styles for these new HTML5 semantic tags. And on top of that, we're saying that article, aside, details, fig caption, etc., are block level elements. This is critical for your document flow. So that way, let's say when you use an article, you're gonna get the same type of document flow that you would with a div tag. Otherwise, everything's gonna be screwed up. So now, when I go here, and I uncomment my HTML5 reset, and I go back to my browser, see the difference now? That's a massive difference. Now we have actual styling, we're able to use the new semantic tags, and we're able to actually render something that looks presentable. And one thing I want to stress is that when you're dealing with non-modern browsers, it's perfectly okay to offer a degraded experience. I think a lot of developers get wrapped up into, oh my God, I have to have everything look exactly the same. I want to use all these features, and they just have to work. No, you don't. You can have that degraded experience. And I am an advocate of that, and I talk to a lot of developers who are advocates of that as well. Now, in this case, this is a perfectly acceptable degraded experience because the only issue we're having here is that border radius won't render because it's not supported in IE7. Being the anal retentive programmer that I am, I want rounded corners. So I'm going to go back here. And what I want to do is I want to load up a shim. Now, as I mentioned, jQuery is my all-time favorite library in the whole world, and you know there's nothing else better than it, and that's final. All right? So I'm going to go ahead and load up jQuery. And what I'm going to do is leverage Modernizer to see if border radius is included in this browser, is supported in this browser. And if it's not supported, I'm going to use the jQuery getScript method to dynamically load a plugin called jQuery Corner and then apply rounded corners to all my article tags. Pretty neat, right? This is what's called a shim. This is how we're talking about using polyfills and shims to mimic behavior that's not supported in non-modern browsers. So if I go here now and I refresh, what do we see? There you go, rounded corners. All right? So this is a great example of leveraging a shim to provide functionality that's not supported by your browser. Any questions up to this point? No? Okay, good. I'll keep going. Now, the video tag is something that everybody's been hot on. Everybody wants to try to use videos without having to worry about some third-party plugin. And that's great. I mean, the video tag is awesome. And I think everybody's used to this type of syntax. You've probably used this at some point, or even if you just embedded a video in your page, you're probably used to seeing this. And that's a lot of gobbledygook. I personally think this is a lot better. That's a lot nicer code. It's very succinct. It's very easy to identify what you're doing. You have a video tag. You're saying, I want to display some controls. I want to specify the width. And here's my video source that I'm going to load up. But the problem that we have is codec support. So does everybody know what a codec is? Okay, good. So in this case, I'm going to show you this graphic. And the interesting part of this is that you have all the major browsers here, including some mobile ones. And it shows the varying levels of support for codecs and how they're going to, whether they're going to render in that specific browser. So for example, we're talking about Internet Explorer, which supports H.264, and it supports WebM. Then we have Firefox, which supports Firefox 3.5, which supports OGG, but doesn't support H.264, and then in 4.0 supports WebM. Then we have Safari that just supports H.264, and Chrome, which supports OGG and WebM, but not at H.264, and then Opera, which supports OGG and WebM, but not H.264. So you can see the conundrum we're in here, right? This is a great example of the browser fragmentation that we're seeing, where we have varying levels of support for key features of an HTML5 feature. So how do you do this? Well, the cool thing is that most of the HTML5 controls have fallback capability so that you can degrade gracefully. So for example, by using using the source attribute or the source tag, you can specify multiple video types that support different codecs very easily. So in this case, what will happen is your code will be read top-down, and if your browser doesn't support MP4, which is H.264, then it'll go to the next one and say, hey, okay, does it support OGG? Well, if it doesn't support OGG, then it's going to go down, and it's going to see, does it support WebM? So this way, you as developers can offer up any type of video for any type of browser. It gives you that flexibility. But what happens when we deal with browser support and non-modern browsers that don't support the video tag? Well, then we have another problem there. So in this case, what are we going to do? We're going to fall back even further. And we're going to look at something like Silverlight, or we're going to look at something like Flash, which will allow you to fall back. So the cool thing about browsers and non-modern browsers is that since the video tag is not supported, they're going to ignore that video tag. And they will continue to go down until they find something they recognize. In this case, it's going to be the object tag. And from there, you can load up your video. So let me show you a demo of this. So in this case, what I'm doing is I have a standard video tag, 640 by 360, I'm going to have some controls, and I'm going to show a video called Big Buck Bunny. Has anybody seen that video? It's kind of cute, huh? Yeah. So I'm going to show it here. Let me bring it up in Internet Explorer. Let me make sure I'm in IE9. So when I bring this up, there's a video. Here are my controls. Check this out now. I'm going to right mouse click. Do you see anything that says silver light? Or you see flash? No, this is standard HTML5 video. This is the cool thing about it. So no third-party plugins running. So if I run this, there's a video. It comes up. You have nice, beautiful music, soothing, you know, relaxing, and it's great. So let me stop this. Now I'm going to go over and I'm going to bring up Firefox 4. Now in Firefox 4, I'm going to run the same video. Oh, wait a minute, it doesn't run. There's a big X here. Okay, well, this is, again, the browser fragmentation issue because Firefox 4 doesn't support H.264. So we have to kind of accommodate for that. So let me go back to my code real quick. And in my code, well, I know that Firefox 4 supports WebM, so that's kind of cool. So let me go ahead and do that. I'll update this. And when I refresh, there's the video. Very cool. This works. I can go through it. Awesome. Well, let me do this. I have Firefox 3.6 in here. This should work in Firefox 3.6 as well, right? Let me bring that up. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's broken, too. What's going on here? Well, unfortunately, Firefox 3.6 doesn't support WebM. So now, as a developer, I have to accommodate for that as well. So I have to go back here and uncomment my Ogg Theora codec. And now when I go there, now it works. Everybody kind of getting the picture here where you're having to manage multiple versions of the same browser? It's what I was talking about before, that you can't just target a browser. You have to look at the specific features that are there and kind of accommodate. In this case, this is tough because codecs are being supported across different codecs are being supported across different browsers. And it's making it very difficult. So you have to have these fallback mechanisms to help you work effectively and build the apps the right way. Now, if I go back to Internet Explorer, let's see what happens when I run in Internet Explorer 7. Well, nothing shows up. Anybody want to tell me why it doesn't show up in Internet Explorer 7? It doesn't recognize the video tag. Good job. Perfect answer. So, again, in order for me to make it work in a non-modern browser, I need to go here. And even though this is an iframe, what it's actually doing is it's loading up the YouTube version of Big Buck Bunny. So now if I go here, there it is. So if we look at the code, let's take a look at this again. It's a video tag. I'm specifying my first H.264 encoded video. Then from there, I'm specifying WebM. Then I'm specifying Ogg. That covers the three major codecs for the modern browsers. That should take care of you. And then for the non-modern browsers, I'm saying let's default to Flash or let's default to Silverlight. Yes. The question that you ask is if you don't have the resources to encode the videos in all the codecs, will the browsers that don't support it fall back accordingly? It's going to be up to you to actually manage that. So what's going to happen is if, let's say, you encode something in H.264 and you want that out, if H.264 is not supported, you're going to have an alternative, and it's probably either going to be Silverlight or Flash. Yes, it'll fall directly right through to whatever you decide, whether it's Silverlight or Flash. So the takeaway here is that, you know, we want to try to avoid browser detection as much as possible. I mean, it's as much as that was an old style method of trying to figure out what features were actually supported and what was available to users. Browsers change constantly. You hear announcements all the time. Chrome is on a 6-week cycle of updates. Firefox just announced that they're going to come out with an update, I think, every 12 weeks or something like that. They're going to have like 4 versions this year. Internet Explorer 8, somebody said 8? Okay, cool. And then you're going to have Internet Explorer, not Internet Explorer 10, which was just announced, and they're going to have platform previews on a 12-week cycle. Opera is coming out on a very increased cadence, and you know, Apple they put out releases on a regular basis too. So you can't depend on that, because in every version that comes out, some new feature is being added in. All right, if you look at the announcement from the keynote on Tuesday, Internet Explorer 9 will support CSS 3D transforms, transitions, Flexbox, a lot of the features that users want. Well, you got to kind of, if you target just solely for Internet Explorer, you're going to have some issues. So you want to do feature detection, because that's the most stable way of ensuring that those features are going to be available to you. And also, look at Modernizer. Modernizer is really, it's an awesome library. It provides you with the feature detection that you want without having to write all this massive amount of code that's going to cause a maintenance nightmare for you later on. All right, let those guys do it. That's what JavaScript libraries are for, especially well-supported ones. They basically abstract these complexities of cross-browser development so that you guys can focus on what's most important to you, building effective and dynamic solutions. And when it comes to polyfills and shims, I am an advocate of it to a certain extent. It has to be something that's reasonably balanced. Remember that anytime you load a JavaScript file, you're adding overhead to your page load times. So you have to be very careful when taking advantage of polyfills. You don't want to have 15, 20 polyfills at the top of your page, and it'll slow down. It not only will increase the size of your page, but then you're going to slow down performance. So you have to be very selective. One of the new libraries that I recommend by a friend of mine, his name is Alex Sexton, and it's called yepnope.js, yepnope.js. And what it is, and I'll bring it up in the browser so you guys can actually check it out. So yepnope is a dynamic script loader. And what it does is it actually will integrate with Modernizer and allow you to test for specific features and load your resources on the fly. This is a great library, because what it does is it says, and look at this code. It says, is Modernizer.geolocation supported? And if it is, then let's go ahead and load in normal.js. If it's not, then let's load up this polyfill and this wrapper that we need to mimic that functionality. This is an awesome library. It's fairly new, but it's gotten a lot of great press, and people are starting to leverage it left and right. The other cool part about it is that it will load your resources in parallel. Remember that when you use a script tag, everything is synchronous. So what's going to happen is it's going to wait till this particular script tag is loaded and executed before it loads the next one. Well, script loaders like yepnope try to load everything in parallel to increase performance. So not only do you get that benefit, you get the benefit of also having feature detection, and now they're integrating directly with Modernizer, so it's built right in for you. This is a really fantastic feature, fantastic library. I recommend it to everybody. Definitely consider using this, because this is my next actual toy that I'm going to play with. Now, if you want to get more familiar with HTML5, these are some of the books that I'm recommending. If you're just starting out, definitely get Introducing HTML5 by Bruce Lawson and Remy Sharp. Fantastic book. It will run you from soup to nuts of all the greatest features out there. HTML5 for Web Designers by Jeremy Keith. I read that book. It's a great intro book as well. If you've already gone past just basic HTML5, that may not be the best book for you, but definitely, if you're just getting into it, great starter book. And CSS3 for Web Designers is always good. Dan Sederholm is just a fantastic author. He's obviously extremely knowledgeable in CSS. I definitely recommend you guys picking up that book. And lastly, if you want to contact me, obviously, I'm here at Ray Bango on Twitter, raybango@microsoft.com, and my blog. I'm always blogging on stuff. And if you guys have any questions about HTML5, JavaScript, CSS3, you can always email me. I'm always willing to answer questions. And, of course, rate me if you can. And if you guys can rate me on the sheets, that'd be perfect. And thank you very much. So at this point, I'd like to take some questions. If you guys have questions, there's a microphone here. You can Yeah, sure.
Yep, nope library for the script loader. Is there, should you also use that, or could you just also use that to load scripts in general with no conditional logic?
I'm sorry, say that again. I couldn't hear you.
Could you just use that script loader to load your scripts in general with no conditional logic as well?
Yeah, that's the point of YepNope. And so what you're asking is, with YepNope, can you use it in place of conditional logic? Absolutely, because basically what it does is it will test the conditional logic.
No, I mean, like you said, hey, it loads all your scripts in parallel. So if you had, I don't know, if you had five scripts at the top of your page that you don't have any conditions you want to check for, just use it to do asynchronous, or would you just use GetScript?
Yes, it will do that for you as well. It provides the asynchronous loading without conditional statements.
Okay, that was question.
Yeah, definitely, okay. Yeah.
It's a little tall there. One question is like, the video tags are great. The way it falls back is great. The one problem that I encounter is having three, four different versions of a video that are identical to each other is kind of tedious, hard on the infrastructure, because now you have to have four times as much space. Mm-hmm. Why can't the browsers act just like every other video player in the world that's on all Macintoshes, all Windows machines, all Linux boxes, pick up what's installed on the machine and use that? So if I provide three different versions, I'm providing three different versions.
Right.
But if the machine has whatever codec it is, because my Macintosh or my Windows machine can run an H.264, can run WebM.
That's a great question. And so, for example, I'm going to use Internet Explorer as an example. Internet Explorer will obviously run H.264, and then if WebM is installed on your machine, it will run WebM. That's why Internet Explorer can support both. You know, in terms of the other browsers, I can't speak for them. I'm not sure what their strategy is for the supporting their various codecs. It's hard for me. I can only say that we took the step, we looked at WebM, and we said, if it's there, we're going to support it, so that if you want encoded, that's what your choice is. If that codec is on the machine, we're going to make sure we render it accordingly.
Okay, so your chart that you had up said that IE didn't support OGG.
I'll go back. There it is. It doesn't support OGG, because OGG is not really pervasive. OGG is not a pervasive codec. So I don't know of many people.
If I install a machine and I can run an OGG video in Windows Video Player, why can't my browser?
I don't have a great answer for you. That's because I'm not part of the Internet Explorer team, so bear with me one second. Let me just load this video up. I mean, this slide up. Because I'm not part of the Internet Explorer team, it's hard for me to be able to tell you this is the mentality. I can only kind of tell you the features that are supported. So, for example, I'm very happy that Internet Explorer offers the WebM support, because a lot of people are really interested in that. So, in terms of OGG, the only thing I can think of as a developer is that OGG is not widely used. So, it'd be neat. If it was there, hey, use it. I can't tell you why it's not in there. It's hard. Yeah. Okay. Thanks for your question, though.
Thanks.
No problem. Any other questions? Come to the mic. Are you okay? Cool. You're there. I don't think that mic's working.
Do you know of any good polyfills that would bring ES3 browsers up to ES5?
There is a polyfill that I recently found, which I haven't tested. That's why I didn't recommend it. And it does provide ES5 capabilities. In that big list, let me bring up that big list. In that big list of polyfills, let me find the actual URL.
I mean, I'm kind of doing that in my own code now, piecemeal, so it would be great if somebody had already implemented all those new APIs.
All right, so here in this big list, and this is why I asked everybody to write this URL down, it's a massive list of polyfills. And again, it's hard. I don't want to recommend too many of them, because I haven't used a lot of them, and I can't tell you if they're good or bad. I mean, I've heard mixed experiences. But for ES5, there is one called ES5 Shim, along with some others, which will provide you with some of the ECMAScript 5 functionality that you're looking for in older browsers. Basically, what it does is, think of it as like a wrapper. It'll say, all right, if you want getters and setters, it's going to create that for you, and it's going to be all the functionality that you would in ES3.
Thank you.
Yeah, so this could help you out. But definitely, that's why I said get this link if you can, because it is a fantastic list of polyfills. Again, I want to stress this to you, though. If you go here and you download a library and you say, I'm going to use it, just make sure that you are able to support it going forward, because if a developer decides to abandon it, or God forbid they're hit by a bus, you know, it's in your hands at that point. Okay?
One of the methods you see promoted online a lot is the idea of taking the new HTML5 elements and then actually putting inside them a div as a wrapper with the same name as the new element to deal with browsers that aren't modern, or the case that maybe JavaScript is turned off or something like that.
Right.
I guess my question is, do you see this as a viable solution, or how good a solution is that? And then how pervasive is this problem of people not really having JavaScript turned on?
You know, I've asked that to a lot of people, including people who are accessibility experts, because those are... Mm-hmm. I was speaking to Stephanie Sullivan. In fact, she was one of the speakers here, and she is part of the WASP group, and that's a big accessibility group. And she said something to me which kind of surprised me. She said, you know, only about 20% of people who use assistive devices don't have JavaScript enabled. Now, obviously, it's 20% is a pretty big figure, but that was kind of shocking. I expected a higher figure. Mm-hmm. So in terms of JavaScript being disabled, I'm not hearing that a lot of sites are encountering that. Contrary, I mean, I'm hearing developers saying, no, I mean, we don't even worry about it because people are surfing with JavaScript enabled. Mm-hmm. So they're not having problems leveraging it. To me, including a div within an HTML5 semantic tag to try to be a fallback, it just seems like extra work. And unless you're writing, I'm not pointing at you specifically, unless you're writing really bad code that's going to break something, I don't think most users are going to have JavaScript disabled. And from what I understand, the screen readers or assistive devices have become so sophisticated that they can understand what JavaScript's trying to do and get past a lot of those things. So there are techniques, but that's not one that I've seen developers using on a regular basis. And yeah. JavaScript, no. I mean, I deal with a lot of JavaScript developers, so maybe I'm biased, but they're all telling me, no, we're building apps, and we're building single-page apps that are all fluttering around and all Ajax-y and DOM manipulation, and they're fine.
Yeah. It would seem if I was going to essentially double the amount of markup I was going to write, there should be a good reason for it.
It definitely would. Okay. It definitely would. So I think what you need to do is just, I'm a big believer in just going there and embracing it. As long as you have that capability where you can actually recognize the semantic tags in non-modern browsers, go for it.
Thank you.
Yep, sure. Uh-oh. Here comes trouble.
No, I'm going to be nice. I think also talking about, because
speak
videos...
Louder, Robert.
Video is one of the big things and all the big problems with different codecs and, well, disk space and infrastructure and all that. And I think we're also going to see, and more just complementing what you said, seeing services like Vidly, for instance, when they offer a service, you just upload a video and then detect it server-side what your browser supports and just serve something like that.
Right.
So you don't need for code for it or anything else. You just have one source attribute that's going to work.
That's a great point, and you're right. Services like Vidly, which will offer that multiple encoding functionality for you, make it substantially easier for you to be able to leverage video in any type of codec you want. So that's a great point. Thank you for bringing that up, Robert. And you're right. I mean, now so much is everybody's talking about cloud, 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 and it's, you know, disk space is almost, it's commoditized now. So you're not going, I'm not seeing a lot of concern now about disk space like I did before. Back, you know, when you were in 1999, you're building a site, yeah, you wanted to kind of worry about that. But with what Microsoft and Amazon and Rackspace and all these cloud providers have done has made it so inexpensive to host these things that you can use something like a Vidly. Vidly's a great service to have multiple encoding supported formats and have a great experience without having to worry about the cost of sustaining those big file sizes. That's a great point, Robert. Thank you. Any other questions? No? All right. Well, thank you so much for coming to my session, guys.